a full table here.
Yep, the day.
Give doctors in, nurses
time, and then meetings in order.
Ready?
All right, we're good.
Good morning. I'd like to call the meeting to order. It's the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. It's Friday, March 21st, 2014. And first bill on our agenda is Senate File 1901, Senator Eaton's bill, and Senator Sharon is going to be presenting Senator Eaton's bill today.
Yes, Senator Eaton makes her apologies. She swears she took the flu shot, but she has a very high temperature and just did not feel like it was wise for her to bring that with her to the Capitol. So I'm happy to offer to your I don't think we have a quorum yet, so I think what we'll do is hear this, and if we have a quorum.
Senator Sharon, we do have a quorum.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. This is the Tanning Equipment Use Age Limit Establishment Bill. What the bill does, committee, is it prohibits minors from using indoor tanning facilities. It requires proprietors of those facilities to hang signage to that effect and imposes penalties. No licensing requirement or inspection is required. The local jurisdictions that already license tanning salons may enforce. Local law enforcement may enforce, so the sting operations like those done with cigarette purchases may be done, but they're not required by the bill. And that's essentially what the bill does. I'm going to leave my comments, because we have a long agenda today, at that point, and introduce, if it's okay, Madam Chair, Dr. Whitney Tope, who is an academic in academia, right? I was here. I just want you to know, is Senator Lori here, or did he just check in and hide?
He's hiding.
He's hiding.
I just wanted to mention, Senator Lori, that I was in a judiciary last night until midnight. So if things aren't coming out in sequence, please understand that. And for those who don't get that joke, at finance yesterday, the testifier addressed me as Your Honor. And, of course, I expect everybody to do that from now on. Oh, sorry. Dr. Tope, you're going to have to follow that.
I'll do my best. This will be a lot drier than that. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Whitney Tope. I'm a dermatologist and dermatologic surgeon in private practice at Academic Dermatology in Edina, Minnesota. By way of my qualifications to speak to you today, I am fellowship trained in skin surgery and cutaneous oncology, which is skin cancer, as well as in laser medicine and photobiology. I'm here today representing, as vice president, the Minnesota Dermatological Society, a professional association of 238 board-certified dermatologists, fellows, and residents across the state. We stand together strongly in support of the Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act. I'm here because my colleagues and I know through hard experience that this is an important health issue for children and teenagers. This legislation has the potential to significantly reduce the risk of skin cancer and to save lives of Minnesotans. I'd like to give you some scientific data to back this up. I will try to keep my comments brief, but there are some important points to be made. Skin cancer is one of the most common problems I face in my practice, simply because skin cancer is the most common form of cancer of all in the United States, outnumbering the cases of lung, breast, colon, and prostate cancers all combined. The American Cancer Society estimates that physicians will diagnose well over 1.5 million new cases of skin cancer this year. Melanoma is among these the deadliest form of skin cancer. Dermatologists deal with this issue on a daily basis. The first handout I provided you is this one, which shows an image of the skin with sunshine radiating down on it. Ultraviolet A and B light rays penetrate the epidermis, the top layer of skin. They disrupt the DNA directly and damage the cell's ability to control its growth. Uncontrolled cell growth leads to skin cancer. Damage to the DNA of melanocytes, in particular, the cells that give the skin its color, can lead to melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. Tanning, or increased skin pigmentation, occurs as a direct result of UV light damage to the melanocytes' DNA. Ironically, while a tan is the body's attempt to protect itself from ongoing DNA damage, A tan is a visible sign of past DNA damage. That's why we tell our patients there is no such thing as a safe tan. I would like to share with you some data, some skin cancer data, linking ultraviolet light exposure through indoor tanning in Minnesotans. And importantly, this is Minnesota data. This is not national data, data from Florida. This is Minnesota data. Dr. Deanne Lazovich, who's a cancer epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health, has studied this issue for over 15 years. She has, to date, conducted the largest and most detailed study on the link between indoor tanning and melanoma here in Minnesota. Dr. Lazovich's results were published about 1 year after the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is an agency of the World Health Organization, declared indoor tanning to be a class 1 human carcinogen. That is a ranking shared by plutonium, cigarettes, and asbestos. Her study added significantly to the weight of the evidence because she was able to document the link between the amount of indoor tanning and melanoma risk, and she was able to measure the risk of melanoma from indoor tanning after accounting for other risk factors for the disease, such as skin and hair color, sun exposure, and sunburns. So her results represent the true risk of melanoma above and beyond the risk of other risk factors. A summary of 27 studies, other studies published since 1988, shows that indoor tanning use before the age of 35 increases the overall risk of melanoma by 59%. With each session of use, an individual increases their risk of melanoma by 2%. Thus, if a teenage girl tanned twice a week for a year, which is a very common practice in Minnesota to maintain a year-round tan, that individual would be doubling her risk, her lifetime risk of getting melanoma. In summary, the scientific evidence that indoor tanning is a cause of melanoma is strong and convincing. Based on this evidence, 14 countries and 6 other U.S. states are protecting our children and teenagers from unnecessary UV exposure by restricting access to minors. It's time for Minnesota to do the same. In addition, the Minnesota Department of Health is very concerned about rising rates of malignant melanoma in Minnesota, especially among young women. The Department of Health, as you may know, is required under state statute to collect, analyze, and report data on all types of cancer that arise in Minnesota. This is accomplished through the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System, or the MCSS, which is our statewide cancer registry. The data in the MCSS, which you see on a graph before you, which should be this image, you've got that. These data show that Minnesota rates are rising. What's not on the data on this graph is that the rates are declining for other forms of skin cancer, for other forms of cancer, but rising for melanoma. Over the last 5 years, Minnesota melanoma rates have increased about 37%. The graph provided plots new cases of melanoma in non-Hispanic white Minnesotans who are aged 20 to 49. You can see there's a marked difference in the trend between the line for women, which is the one on top, represented by circles, and the one for men on the bottom, represented by triangles. Melanoma rates are increasing in younger women at a rate of almost 5% per year and have doubled since 1995. Minnesota melanoma is now the most common cancer diagnosed among women in their 20s. There's also separate and important new data about indoor tanning among teenagers reported in the Minnesota Student Survey. This survey asked Minnesota middle school and high school students questions about their activities, experiences, and behaviors every 3 years. It's administered jointly by Minnesota Departments of Education, Health and Human Services, and Public Safety. For the first time in the 2013 study, there were included questions about indoor tanning use. This Minnesota student survey found that among 11th grade girls, white girls, one in three, or a third of them, reported that they had tanned indoors in the last year. And among those 11th graders who tanned indoors, more than half tanned indoors 10 or more times in a year. These 11th graders would qualify in Dr. Lazovich's study as frequent tanners who would have doubled their risk of melanoma just in that 1 year. This is why the Minnesota Dermatological Society strongly supports this legislation. Young developing skin is particularly sensitive to damage from ultraviolet light, and this damage is cumulative. No child should be permitted to purposefully expose him or herself to indoor cancer-causing ultraviolet radiation. What we're currently doing to protect Minnesota's teens from skin cancer is not working. Like prohibiting the sales of cigarettes to minors, we must move to restrict access of children to tanning beds. I speak to here today for my colleagues and for myself, but also for my patients. As a general and surgical dermatologist, I care for patients in their 20s and 30s and beyond with skin cancer and with melanoma. I routinely question them about past and present tanning bed use. The majority have used tanning beds in their teens, and a significant proportion become addicted to tanning. The fortunate patients understand that their skin cancer is attributable to their tanning bed use and stop this behavior if they have not already done so. You need to experience caring for only one of these patients who dies of melanoma to know that this is at best a painful, undignified, costly, and all the more tragic death because it's preventable. Much of the melanoma and death from melanoma we dermatologists see, is preventable, I believe, if we can halt the use of the tanning or the development of the tanning habit. This act will help us do that. I hope that you will support me in supporting this act, this bill. Thank you very much. I'll take your questions, if there are any.
Thank you, Dr. Tobe. Do you wish to have the other testifier speak first, or did you have another testifier?
If you'll stay close by in case there are questions, I would proceed then with some brief testimony from some family members who'd like to tell you their story, Megan Ramey and Pam Sievert, we are introducing a survivor and a parent, and I thought you might be interested in hearing from them as well.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record, whoever's going to begin, and if I can encourage you to try and keep your testimony brief, I would really appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Megan Ramey. Good morning. Thank you all for being here so early to listen to our story. As I said, my name is Megan Ramey. This is my mother, Pam Sievert. We are here today to speak in support of the Minnesota Skin Cancer Prevention Act. 4 years ago, I never would have imagined I'd be speaking to all state lawmakers today. But 4 years ago, I never thought I'd be battling stage 3 melanoma. As a teenager, like so many others, I wanted a healthy glow before special events such as prom and vacations. I was also a competitive figure skater, so I tanned before skating competitions. The area in which I lived had a tanning salon at the end of my street, so tanning was very accessible to me. At the time, I had no idea the risk I was taking, and neither did my parents. We thought it was okay to tan once in a while. After all, a majority of the girls in my high school tanned more than I did. Plus, the salons always assured me I was tanning the safe way by monitoring my time in the tanning beds and building a tan gradually over time. I knew tanning put me at risk for skin cancer, but I honestly thought skin cancer was no big deal. To me, skin cancer was a lesion on your skin easily removed by minor surgery in a dermatology office, the cut it out and forget about it type of stuff. I also thought skin cancer was something that I would possibly be dealing with in my old age, never in my 20s. I never knew there was a type of skin cancer called melanoma that is such more serious and even fatal. At 20, when I was a student at Mankato State University, I noticed a mole on my lower back that bothered me. It was itchy, tender to the touch, and would bleed. I went to my local urgent care, but they didn't seem to think the mole was anything to be concerned about. The bleeding and irritation continued for a few more months until I was able to return home and have my general physician take a look. Immediately, my doctor wished to remove and biopsy the lesion. It would only be a few days before she called with the results that I had melanoma, the most deadly form of skin cancer. I had a wide excision of my skin removed, lymph nodes tested, and eventually a full lymph dissection of my upper right groin area. After surgery, I began 1 month of high-dose interferon treatment, which, by the way, cost $40,000, so I'm very fortunate to have had good insurance coverage. The cancer has been removed, and I have been labeled NED, or no evidence of disease, for full 3 years. But because melanoma has such a high reoccurrence rate, I also have completed 2 years of weekly injections of a drug called Cylotron, or a pegylated interferon, to help reduce my chances of the disease coming back. I continue to live my life in six-month increments, never knowing when my next scan is going to show active cancer. I'd like my story to be a cautionary tale to other young people. A tan is not worth risking your life for. I wholeheartedly believe that if tanning beds were restricted to those age 18 and older, it would send a strong message to just how dangerous this practice is.
Thank you, Ms. Ramey.
Thank you.
Hi. Hi, I'm Pam Sievert. I'm Megan's mom. And I thank you for listening to us today. As a mother, I thought I was doing everything that I could to keep my daughter safe. She was a good student and had lots of friends and had wonderful opportunities ahead of her.
I had no idea the risks of indoor tanning. I knew skin cancer was caused by too much sun exposure, but I assumed that that was later in life and that was easily removed. I come from a generation of sun worshipers who spent lots of hours outside in a lawn chair, slathered with baby oil and trying to soak up as many rays as possible. People my age are now suffering the effects of their poor choices, but I never thought that I would have to see my daughter through the effects of sunless tanning. Some tanning salons even advocate that using tanning beds is safe and that safer than lying out in the sun. Now knowing the truth about UV exposure and tanning beds, I believe that prohibiting children from using tanning beds would be a huge help to parents. We assume that our consumer protection laws protect us. We would like to think that tanning would not be allowed for children unless it was proven safe. We appreciate age-restrictive laws that protect our children from cigarettes and alcohol. Much like curfew laws, this law will support parents in our daily efforts to keep our children safe. As a parent who wishes I had known better, I ask you today to protect other children and to educate parents by voting for the Skin Care Prevention Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Siebert.
Senator, we will... I don't think there's anyone here to speak against this, so we would entertain questions. If you can inquire about that, but if there's someone here to testify against this bill, I'm uncertain about that. I did not hear that.
Yeah, is there anyone who is here who wishes to testify in opposition? Seeing no one approach, are there any questions that members have? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, or you, I don't know if any of these witnesses or Senate counsel, but local governments are allowed to license this, so this $300 maximum if somebody's repeating violation. Senate counsel, I assume the obligation, the ability of the local government would be to shut them down if they keep violating it, if the local government chose to do so. We're not changing any local.
That is correct.
Senator Sherman. Okay. Any other questions? Hearing no other questions, Senator Sharon, do you have any other statements to make?
Would you offer me the motion that's in front of you?
The motion would be to pass Senate File 1901 and lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
That's my motion.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1901 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Wicklund.
Senate File 2775, School Discipline Policies Health Impact Study Appropriation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm here today to present Senate File 2775. This is regarding allocating funds to conduct a health impact assessment. We would gather together stakeholders to study the health impacts of school discipline policies. That's the subject matter covered in this health impact assessment, and we would make and they would make evidence-based recommendations back to policymakers for use in decision making regarding this topic. This is a way to look at the effects, both intended and unintended effects, of policies on the health of a population. Because we know that multiple factors contribute to health, it would bring together education, public health, mental health, employment, criminal justice, all these different stakeholders and experts, and it's something that would be driven by community, by the community. This particular effort came out of an interest that I believe many of us on the committee share in looking for solutions to health disparities issues that we all see going on, and trying to find a way to move past just seeing the issue and come to better decisions about policy directions. The Minnesota Department of Health Advancing Health Equity Report triggered an interest for me in the use of this tool, the Health Impact Assessment, both as one that could address this particular issue, which I think there's a great sense of urgency to understand better why we were seeing such a disparity in school discipline rates in various communities, and also as a secondary interest in looking at this tool as a possible way that the legislature can gain knowledge and be informed and make better policy decisions based on, you know, a structured process of bringing the information towards us. So today I have Jean Ayers is here to speak from the Minnesota Department of Health regarding the health impact assessment. And then Pastor Paul Slack is here, who has been involved in this this concept of the school discipline policy health impact assessment, and he'll speak as a community member and knowledgeable expert on the topic. So first I'd like Jean Ayers to speak.
Welcome, Ms. Ayers.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jean Ayers, and I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I co-chair the initiative that was responsible for the legislative report on advancing health equity in Minnesota. My remarks will be focused primarily on the health impact assessment as a tool to advance health equity and support healthy public policymaking. The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, social, and mental well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Research shows that healthcare itself is actually only a small fraction, about 10% of what contributes to health. Our health is primarily created in the community through social, economic, and environmental factors, as well as individual behaviors and biology. But differences or disparities in how long we live, as well as the quality of our lives, are rooted in the policies that form the characteristics of our living conditions. So many of our dominant health problems that face the state today, obesity, cancer, diabetes, mental illness, and the disparities that range across health outcomes stem actually from the policies that create these social and environmental factors. So significant improvements in health and reductions in health disparities will occur if the health impacts of our policies are more fully considered, particularly in sectors that historically have been viewed as unrelated to health, such as education and transportation, corrections, housing. This understanding has led to the recommendation in the recommendation that says advance health equity through a health in all policies approach across all sectors that was included in the legislative report. One promising approach to this is a health impact assessment, or HIA. It's basically a combination of procedures, methods, and tools that systematically bring together the scientific data, health expertise, and public impact to identify the effects of a proposed policy or project or program on the health of the population and also on the distribution of those effects within a population. And HIA offers practical recommendations for ways to manage those effects and capitalizes on the opportunity to improve health. It looks at health from a broad perspective. It makes clear judgments on how a proposal will affect health. It helps build public understanding and by bringing community members and business interests and stakeholders together, which can help develop consensus and it highlights disparities or differences in the health between groups and considers whether the impacts of a particular policy will affect vulnerable groups in different ways. The proposed bill is an example of this type of policy consideration, the type of policy consideration that would benefit from a health impact assessment. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wicklund, you have Pastor Paul Slack with you.
Correct.
Would you like to begin, Pastor Slack?
Yes, Your Honor, Senator Sharon. Thank you.
You can have an extra minute.
That's what I was hoping for. Again, my name is Pastor Paul Slack. I'm actually ecstatic that our great state has this opportunity to study research and data in disparate school discipline policies and their impact on the racial achievement gap and the health of youth and families and communities. Much of my adult life, I've worked in one way or another in closing the educational achievement gap. From starting off with my kids, and I always taught my children that they were never supposed to fight but resolve any kind of conflict, anything with their words, and by asking trusted adults to help them out in the process. Actually showing up at my school from the very earliest age when they had some minor or major discipline problems to try to aid and assist my children in resolving the problem, only to be rebuffed, and when asked by the administrator what the problem was, you know, I was told in a matter-of-fact way that teachers just aren't accustomed to talking to African-American men when they show up to help their children, and so they were afraid of me when I came up there, and I said, okay, what is it? Is it something that I wear, or do I need to lower my tone? And repeatedly on a number of occasions, I was just told in a matter-of-fact way that that's what it is because they were just unaccustomed to helping. Two, one of my children being disciplined because he wanted to come to his younger brother's aid when a group of white kids were around him teasing him, and so using one of his best gifts, his mouth, he tried to resolve the issue, and he was the only one who received any discipline for the issue. To my other child being disciplined because a young lady hit him in the head with a big ball, and she had been teasing him for a number of days and weeks, and no one had intervened, and so when he was hit in the head with this basketball, he said a swear word. And it was actually not one of my proudest moments in my life because at which point, seeing that he was the only one singled out, I actually advised him that the next time someone took such courses to throw something at him like that and nothing happened, that he should hit them. Again, it wasn't one of my proudest moments, but being frustrated time and time again and seeing that no one's respecting him or working to intervene in either his life or the young lady's life, I was simply lost and frustrated and didn't know what else to do. I later thankfully recounted, and he was the child of mine who would never resort to violence, and I guess I had just instilled it in his head. So I'm thankful that he remembered my earlier lessons and not the one that I was resorting to at the moment. Seeing many of those cases, not just from my kids interacting with other students, but having a teacher called one of my children a punk and then the school administrator defending the teacher's right to call him what I'd always been taught was a very, very bad word. And other issues and cases like that, too, in my church, one of my children in my church being sent to another school, suspended from his school, having to start at another school because nobody intervened on his behalf early enough, and they were ashamed to come and ask for my help to help them partner and intervene with them. I've just seen far, far too many disparate discipline policies, and I've seen too many of my kids get in trouble time and time again without giving an opportunity for alternative solutions to the discipline that they were achieving.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there others who would you stay at the table, please? Are there others who are wishing to testify in support or in opposition to this bill this morning? Seeing no one, then since you're still at the table, I want to open it to the committee members in case they would like to ask some questions on this portion of the bill.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wicklund, thank you for bringing this forward. Many years ago, there was a study, public health, and there is a public health interest in what happens throughout our school districts, and I appreciate this going forward. And I'd like to offer in the same tone, in the same sense, an amendment, which is, could we pass around the A1 amendment? And members, as you're looking at this, it's consistent with Senator Wicklund's bill that provides a health impact assessment. My amendment relates to the health disparities that exist in our state. And also note that this amendment is simply a starting point this session, as we've reached out to stakeholders, including the Department of Health, to refine this language during the session. The background for this amendment is based on the fact that while Minnesota does well on statewide averages of health of people in our state, we know, because we've talked about this among ourselves, is the health disparities for some communities are among the most extreme in the nation. So this amendment just addresses two major goals. Reports the quality of measure by race, ethnicity, language, disability, and other social determinants, so that we can identify the health disparities, and then ensures a safety net providers that serve communities and also those low-income populations are not penalized under evolving measurement efforts. Because there will be a fiscal note, this is just a placeholder language at the time. And I do want to just look, please, at two points where some wording got left out. Line 1.21, after the word language, add a disability in there. And then in line 1.32, the same subset after the word language, add disability. A report that was done by, I remember the person who did the report at Public Health, Sarah Thorson, showed that the health disparities and the impact assessment of people with disabilities was just way outside of any range. So Michael Sanskrit from Safety Net Coalition and also the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, Jim Koppel, is here if there are any questions that people might have.
Please approach the desk. We will first take action on the oral amendment to the amendment. The oral amendment to the amendment. Ms. Cavanaugh, would you read that to make certain that our committee understands the amendment?
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, lines 21 and 32, before race, insert disability, comma.
Any discussion on the amendment to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes. I think we'll now take testimony on the amendment and then allow some questions. Thank you very much.
Do you want me to move?
Michael Scandrett and Mr. Jim Koppel.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Scandrett. I'm with the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition, and Jim Koppel's here from the Department of Health, but only available if you need his assistance on the perspective of the department. And I'll be very brief because there's more work that's coming on the bill before we can get it moved out of finance. So this committee knows about health disparities, and we've had some discussion already about that, and it's all about statewide averages show that Minnesota's doing pretty well, but you look below the surface and break those numbers down, and you see that there are very wide disparities for communities of color and other groups within. On the topic of quality measurement, the same thing exists. We've got a really great system of reporting quality of care and health outcomes in our system, but they only show the averages for all the patients served. They don't break it down by the race, ethnicity, and language and other factors, which doesn't give us an accurate picture. What this bill does then is to look at those statewide quality measures and move toward being able to break those down further beyond the overall average to get to what is the quality of care and the health outcome for particular communities of color or other people who are facing socioeconomic factors that affect their health and their quality of care and result in disparities. And then the second thing is, Senator Hoffman said, is to be sure that when those quality measures are used in pay-for-performance and other payment-related settings, that those providers who have a lot of patients with those characteristics are not penalized because they're serving patients who are already starting out with a lot of barriers, poorer health, and less access to care. So it's really just about let's find out what the disparities are so we can do more about them, and let's make sure that those providers who are serving these populations are not penalized because they choose to serve them. And again, we'll be working further on this bill before finance, so appreciate the opportunity to kind of move this bill ahead today. Now, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony. I would remind everyone that's here, we don't need to remind the committee because we've had hearings on very specifically on the subjects of these two proposals, Senator Wicklund's and Senator Hoffman's. And a major theme for us is acknowledging, recognizing health disparities and to quit having conversations about them, but to begin to take a look at what needs to be done to change it. So that's one of the major themes of our committee, and so this certainly aligns with moving us towards a better outcome. And Senator Wicklund.
I would just like to say I would see this as a friendly amendment, and we I see it as related, and I certainly understand that we're trying to get to accomplish a lot today, the last day we can hear the policy bills. So I'm satisfied that this is an appropriate
amendment
addition to the.
Okay. Are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. And on the bill itself, Senator Wicklund, your motion would be move that Senate File 2775 be passed and move to finance as amended. And that is your motion?
That is my motion.
Okay. All those
Thank
in
you.
Favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Bill passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Sharon.
Thank you. This is, first of all, I am here to present Senate File 1484 and have a delete all amendment to Senate File.
1484.
I keep my numbers straight here.
Senate File 1484.
1484, yes, thank
dental
you.
Dental licensing provisions modifications, and the A1 amendment is in your packet.
A3.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it A3?
A3, yeah.
The A3 amendment.
Quick.
I don't know.
Oh, she took it.
Yeah, so
far back on your phone. For this one, I'll go on good.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I would like to offer the A3 delete all amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the A3 delete all amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you. Members of the committee, this is a compilation of the health-related licensing board's legislation that will be passed today. And we have heard all of these bills and taken testimony on them, but we haven't moved them forward to finance, which is where it will move from here. So today we're going to review these for a final disposition. And in order to accomplish that, what I think might be helpful is that we just move through each section of the bill and stop at the end of each, ask if there are any questions at that point, and then move on. So with that, if you would assist me, Ms. Kavanaugh, in going through the bill and explaining what is in this for us.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
Madam Chair, members, you want to go through each section? Do you want? How about, would it make
sense? I would take your suggestion.
Would
if
it
you
make had more sense to maybe highlight what has changed in any of these bills since the bills that did go to other committees?
Are you able to identify which bills by title, by so that people know which of the licensing bills are in here, and then we can go through the changes for those bills that went through other committees?
Madam Chair and members, there is a handout in really big print about all the bills that are in each article. In Article 1, the base bill, 1484, which was originally Senator Hayden's bill, the Board of Dentistry, there are no changes from the last time we heard that one. Article 1 also has 1890, which is Senator Sharon's bill, the Board of Nursing and the Health Professional Services Program. That went through Judiciary, and there were several changes. On page 4, section 2, the conviction of, in Article 1, the conviction of felony-level criminal sexual offense, that was changed. I don't know, Senator, if you want to point out the differences that were adopted in Judiciary.
In which?
In Article 1, Section 2, this was the conviction of felony-level criminal sexual offense. That was changed in Judiciary. I believe they changed it to be the same sort of setup that the Board of Chiropractic has currently in their
statute. Are you talking about the Board of Nursing's bill?
Yes.
Yeah. If we just identify what's in, what the general topic are that are in here, and then we'll go through the sections where there are changes.
Okay.
So the Board of Nursing bill is in this omnibus bill.
Okay. That's in Article 1. In Article 2 are the two Board of Pharmacy bills. Actually, 2134 is not Senator Sharon's. That's Senator Rosen's as well. That's the prescription monitoring program, and 2135, Senator Rosen's Board of Pharmacy bill. Both of these bills also have to go. They're in Judiciary. They have yet to be heard in Judiciary. Any changes that will come out of that committee, we will amend into this bill in Finance. And Article 3 is Senate File 511, Senator Sharon's Advanced Practice Registered Nurses bill.
Okay.
Senator Sharon.
Yes. So the first, I haven't tracked the actual bill. We just got this morning. So can you direct me to the first bill where we need to take a look at changes?
Members, then it'd be Article 1, Section 2. This is the Board of Nursing section with the felony level criminal sexual offense. That was changed and amended in Judiciary.
Senator,
thank
Sharon.
You, members. This language under Section 2 is language that the Judiciary Committee is implementing into every licensing bill that deals with this issue, so that there is an alignment on the issue throughout all of the boards. And in particular, of interest is of your interest would be to notice that on lines 4.25, on page 4, 4.25 and 4.26, that deals with the ability of the board to refuse to license persons convicted of felony-level criminal sexual offenses. As you know, in the course of conversations in a variety of places, we've been concerned about youth offenders, persons who may be caught in what we call the Romeo-Juliet situation. And so we have extracted from the general statement of felony conviction those parts of the law that would impact youth offenders, so that this really is very high-level criminal sexual conduct and eliminates youthful offenders of the lower-level offenses, not major offenses, major crimes. Are there any questions about that?
Okay. Members have any questions about that section?
We also changed in the Judiciary Committee language that was more discretionary for the boards. Remember the conversation about whether or not a discharge from the HPSP program would be automatic, because the discharge would be a consequence of failing to follow the management program. The language in this bill changes the term from shall to may, which makes it more a capacity of the boards to review the data and make a determination. And that came not only from the Board of Nursing, but from the other boards who are impacted by changes in this language as well.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, is that the language on page 4, that list of things, that's just where the board may discipline based on those things,
yes,
and others. It's not shall. And, Madam Chair, is that same language going to be in other boards as well?
Yes, because this language affects all of the boards.
Right. Oh, this is.
I think. Is that true or not true?
Not true.
Surely it says it's not true, so let's get the truth.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Shirley Breckham. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing. Senator Marty, in answer to your question, Section 2 actually applies to Chapter 148, which is the Board of Nursing, the Nurse Practice Act. And I'm sorry, I don't know where it is in here, but there is an additional provision. It's in the House version, the same language, but it applies to Chapter 214, which applies to all of the health-related licensing boards.
It's on page.
Thank you, Katie.
It's on page 18, Section 20.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Brecken, did you complete your? Okay. Senator Marty, did that?
Madam Chair, Ms. Kavanaugh, I'm looking at Section 20. Is the same language, or you're saying there's a
Madam
similar
Chair, Senator Marty, this is the language that applies. It basically, this is that the Board of Manager or the Program Manager of the Health Professional Program is required to report to each participating health-related licensing board when a regulated person does any of these, if any of these things apply to that regulated person.
Ms. Brecken?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, Ms. Kavanaugh, that Section 20 applies to the reporting by the program, the Health Professional Services Program. It does not the same language, the same issue as conviction of a felony-level criminal sexual offense in Section 2.
All right. Is that your question?
Would you repeat your question, Senator Marty?
So, which error was your question about, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I was interested in knowing if the discharge from HPSP that applies in Chapter 148 here, if that's similarly applying to other health licensing boards, or this is different.
So it is. You're asking about the health services program, the discharge process
from
that.
Clause 29, yes. And I see the page 18 or page 18 has what HPSP has to tell the boards. I'm just curious if the language that's similar to other health boards have.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty,
it applies to all.
The answer is yes.
The answer is
yes. The answer is yes. That applies to all health licensing boards.
Yes. Section 1, though, is specifically amending the Board of Nursing statute, but it sounds like they already have that authority? Other boards?
Ms. Bracken?
Madam Chair, Ms. Kavanagh, no, only the Board of Chiropractic Medicine and the Board of Medical Practice. Which one are we back on?
You're back to Kavanagh. The felony. Okay. Senator Marty is talking about the discharge from the health professional program.
Okay.
So we're on two different topics here.
Yes. Okay.
Three.
I think three.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, Section 20 would, as I said, apply to all of the health-related licensing boards, and it is language that was heard in Judiciary the other night. It was amended a bit from what there was. It added numbers 8 and 9, altering a prescription without the knowledge of the prescriber for the purpose of obtaining a drug for personal use, and then unlawfully using a controlled substance or mood-altering chemical, essentially while on duty or on call.
And
Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Senate Counsel, that provision is going to be true for all the boards.
Yes.
But my question was about clause 29 in the Board of Nursing's grounds for discipline. Is that language very similar to what other boards have or going to have? Or
it's for discipline. Where is that?
How does that relate to what other boards have?
You're speaking now about on page
clause 29 on page 4.16.
Lines 4.16. Ms. Kavanagh.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, that I'm not sure. The Board of Nursing is specifically amending their statute to put this in their list of grounds of disciplinary action. I'm not sure if the other boards in the current list that they have, whether that would fall in one of those grounds that they would be able to. I would think that it probably would. But the Board of Nursing it specifically is adding that.
Senator Lurie, did you have another question?
I think maybe a clarifying statement that is our language here on page 4, line 416 is what Senator Marty is referencing. And what he is asking about that is that in all licensing boards? And the answer to that is that in this bill it refers specifically to the Board of Nursing. I don't know if the rules allow me to talk about the House, but the House has broadened that language to incorporate it into all boards. But our bill, as it's moved through the committees, has kept it specific to the Board of Nursing. Does that answer your question, Senator Martin?
Madam Chair, exactly. In other words, it does not now apply elsewhere, but the House bill has it that way. Yours does not.
That's correct.
Further questions about these sections?
And that completes the changes in this Board of Nursing bill.
Were there changes in the Board of Dentistry bill, Senator Hayden's bill, that we need to discuss?
There are no changes from what was presented.
Senator Hayden, do you?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, I do have the A5 amendment that is an agreement between the Dental Association and the Board of Dentistry, if I can offer that.
Senator Hayden offers the A5 amendment.
I'll need a copy of the amendment.
It will be distributed.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Hayden.
Senator Sharon, this is an agreement by the two groups. Under the amendment, the first failed audit is an educational opportunity. No penalty assessed, but the licensee is subject to another audit. Additional failed CE audits would result in an increased penalty from a maximum of $250 for the second failure within 10 years and up to $1,000 for any additional failures within 10 years. And then finally, those penalties would be moderated based on the individual's profession, recognizing that dental assistants and a dentist typically have different abilities to pay. And once again, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, this is an agreement between the Dental Association and the Board of Dentistry.
Are there any questions about the amendment or comments? So Senator Hayden moves to adopt the A5 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Okay, thank you very much. The next section that we should be focusing on, Ms. Kavanaugh, would be Article 2, Board of Pharmacy.
Madam Chair and members, there are no changes. Again, that those two bills have yet to be heard in Judiciary. So
if there are changes, we will incorporate them into this bill.
Correct.
Is there anything else in Article 2 that you've identified that we should be reviewing?
Madam Chair, no. Those are just the two bills, the two pharmacy bills. So.
Is there anything from the committee on those bills?
Are there any questions, members? Hearing no questions on those.
And the next bill, the page, I'm sorry, I'm paging through. I haven't had a chance to mark up my copy of the bill.
Madam Chair, is Article 3. That's the Advanced Practice Registered Nurse Bill, 511. And the language in the amendment is what we adopted when we heard this bill earlier.
In the page that is in here?
It starts on page
79. Okay, thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Okay, we do have an amendment to we're trying to get the right person here in case there's questions that people want to ask about this. It's the A7 amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the A7 amendment, and that'll be distributed. Senator Sharon, do you wish to speak to your amendment?
I don't. Do I hear? But you can speak to this. I guess the best. I'm not a CIC.
Yes, this is an amendment that addresses pain intervention therapies. As you, as the committee remembers, in the discussion of the APRN bill, and in the course of our conversations with the stakeholders, there was a desire to find a way to address much more clearly an articulation of the boundaries that exist for the CRNAs around a pain management intervention. And this pain intervention therapies amendment does that by articulating clearly what it is that can occur for the CRNA. And so I would offer that amendment, and then we can have further discussion.
Members, do you have any questions about the amendment? Senator Sharon.
Would you like to go through the contents of this? This is new to the committee, so it is important to this committee to understand what is in this amendment because it is an effort to try to resolve some of the issues from the stakeholders. Not that all issues have been resolved, but clearly the amendment has articulated more clearly for the members of the committee what it is that's being, the limits are in terms of the practice for the CRNA.
Thank you, and please welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Huber. I am the president of the Minnesota Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I am a practicing certified registered anesthetist here in the Twin Cities. The amendment that we are referring to would probably start in on line 1.6, providing anesthesia and analgesia for acute and chronic pain symptoms through non-invasive and interventional therapies, including the use of image guide technology as needed for selected therapy. And then you want me to... I'm sorry, I'm not quite... When we're talking about nurse anesthesia practice, we have concluded also that nurse anesthesia practice does not include the surgical implantation of intrathecal infusion pumps or spinal cord stimulators, surgical implantation of cements or plastics near or around the spinal column, non-traumatic laser discectomy, non-traumatic endoscopic discectomy, percutaneous vertebroplasties, percutaneous vertebral augmentation procedures, and percutaneous kyphoplasties. Those are the procedures that we would not be practicing or doing as nurse anesthetists in Minnesota.
I would just add at this point that we understand that some of the committee members were receiving expressions of concern that nurses would be caring, would be doing this kind of pain management, which, although the nurses were clear in their communication that that was inaccurate, we thought that the best way to deal with that was to articulate it in writing.
Thank you. Ms. Huber.
Yes. Pain intervention therapies. The implementation of non-surgical pain intervention therapies may only be provided upon referral by a physician, dentist, podiatrist, physician assistant, chiropractor, or an advanced practice registered nurse to a licensed registered nurse anesthetist who has exhibited the requisite knowledge and competency by submitting to the board the following.
Excuse me for interrupting. I just want to highlight a word there, referral. That's an important word for you to pay attention to because it highlights again and is clear the concerns about a person just going off and doing something on their own in this area is not what that has to occur only in relationship to referral. So it has to be a referral.
Ms. Huber.
Document completion of a postgraduate study program in advanced pain management therapies and image-guided technology that is acceptable to the board, or an advanced pain management specialty certification by a nationally or regionally accredited organization that is acceptable to the board. A registered nurse anesthetist who does not meet the education certification requirements specified in this section by January 1st, 2016, but who has been providing advanced pain management therapies prior to December 31st, 2015, may continue to provide these therapies if the registered nurse anesthetist provides the board with documentation of these practices in these therapies within the two-year period prior to December 31st, 2015.
That's it, I think. And that's a summary of the A7 amendment.
Committee members, do you have any questions about the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
So are we going to have further testimony for those that may think that this is not the right?
You know, I'm willing to hear testimony, because this is new, we could hear specifically to this particular issue.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd be very interested in just kind of getting a broad, holistic view of how people feel about this. Senator Sharon, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Is there someone who wishes to testify regarding specifically Amendment A7? Please come to the table and... Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. David Schultz. I'm a board-certified anesthesiologist and a board-certified interventional pain physician. I'm also an adjunct professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Minnesota. And I've spoken to the committee before. I want to reiterate that the medical specialty of interventional pain management is a high-risk medical specialty that draws from interventional radiology, neurosurgery, PM&R and interventional radiology. And as a doctor with medical school training, residency training, and fellowship training, we become board certified in pain management, and then we are qualified to practice in this field. The amendment talks about a few of the more high-tech, high-risk procedures that some of us do. Most interventional pain doctors don't do these procedures here. These are often neurosurgical procedures. I do some of them, but my partners don't, for instance. But there are far more procedures that are not on this list that I do on, and other pain doctors do on a routine basis that are very high risk for the patient. These are head and neck procedures where the needle is placed into the skull, into the cervical spine, very close to the carotid artery, the vertebral artery. And if our needles are a millimeter off and we misinterpret a dye pattern, the patient can be paralyzed or can be killed by the procedure. So these are high-risk neurosurgical procedures that we're doing, and it takes intense training to be able to do them. And if we step back a little bit, CRNAs are not trained to do fluoroscopic injections for chronic pain in their training. And I challenge any of the CRNAs to tell me whether they have ever in their training performed a fluoroscopically guided injection. The answer is no, they're not trained to do that. Anesthesiology residents are not trained to do that. It takes a fellowship training beyond board certification in anesthesiology to get that done. Secondly, this field involves the diagnosis and management of complex patients with medical diseases, chronic pain diseases, that take medical training and background in order to diagnose and treat these folks. Now, nurse practitioners get training in diagnosis of diseases and management of diseases. CRNAs do not get the same training that NPs get. They do not learn how to diagnose and treat patients with chronic diseases. They learn how to do surgical anesthesia and pre-op and post-op care. So I think that they're completely unqualified to be practicing in this high-tech, high-risk medical specialty. Any questions?
Are there any questions for the Senator Sharon, did you have
Yes,
any
I think that it's important to allow us to have an opportunity to respond.
Ms. Huber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under our scope of practice as certified registered nurse anesthetist, we have multiple pain management procedures that we can do and do safely and been doing for 20 years or more in this state. This allows many of patients to access their health care in their hometowns, rural areas that do not have interventional pain management clinics. So thus asking someone who lives in Mora, Minnesota, to drive either down to the Twin Cities or perhaps to Duluth to get an epidural steroid injection is a very big burden on them. Many of them don't even have transportation. The nurse anesthetist in Mora actually drives some of his patients home after they've received their epidural steroid injections. So under our scope of practice and the education that our CRNAs receive and additional pain management therapy, they are competent and safe practitioners to provide these other modalities of pain management. We are granted in statute that we can use fluoroscopy for these different types of steroid injections that I'm referring to in our back, and that's in state statute. And it says that certified radiology technologists, licensed dental hygienists, registered dental assistants, certified registered nurse anesthetists, and registered physician assistants may use x-rays, fluoroscopies, to determine where they are going to be placing these injections. We are not necessarily we're having referrals from other healthcare providers to tell us that they want the patients to receive pain management, pain intervention. We are not diagnosing, but we are providing treatment that has been referred to us. So I think that's a very important fact to bring out. And as you had asked prior, we are not having independent clinics. All the treatment that is being provided for pain management is within a licensed facility, such as a surgery center or a hospital.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions or elaborate?
May I respond to that?
Just let me ask the committee members if they have questions first. Is there any question or committee members? Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to ask the CRNA, have you ever performed a fluoroscopically guided injection in your training? Have you ever been trained to do so?
I'm going to be very honest and say no, I don't do that in my background because right now I'm working as a solo practitioner doing infertility anesthesia. So no, in my practice, no, I do not. But I do have someone here who does do pain management if you would like them to respond to that.
If that's a question that the committee would like to address to a person who has that skill set, then I'll offer that up. And if you have questions, then direct them to me, and we can. Do any members wish to have ask that type of question of a? No. Okay. Senator Sharon, did you?
Well, that's why I emphasized the term about referral. You know, it requires a referral in order for a procedure to occur. So that's really a major controlling factor here. So,
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, before we vote on the amendment, I think I don't know all these words, but it seems to me line 17, augmentation, is spelled wrong.
On 1.17. Okay. Council, so they can.
I did not spell those words on that book.
Senator Sharon, did you have? Did you have anything to add?
No, not in terms of this amendment.
Are members ready to vote on the amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the A7 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. And now we're back to, are there further changes that we haven't discussed?
My understanding is that there is, I think Ms. Kavanaugh alerts me to another correction that needs to be made in the language as it was prepared. On page 88.
Madam Chair and members, it's not another correction. It was an amendment that just didn't get written. On page 88, deleting lines 25 to 26, the title changed, permitting the advanced practice registered nurse to refer to him or herself as a doctor.
Okay, yes. Thank you for this is something that continued to be in conversation since we've last been in front of this committee. A request to have, the issue about titles always comes up around this and confusion. So this was an agreement on the advanced doctorate prepared nurses to agree to not use the term. And so that is an oral amendment to exclude language on 8825 and 8826. That's a friendly amendment.
So everyone, committee members, do you all understand the oral amendment that's just been put forward? Any questions? All those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
And that completes the changes that were in this portion of the bill.
Senator Sharon, do you have another amendment?
This is to the Board of Nursing bill, right? I'm sorry. Isn't this the Board of Nursing bill? I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
But the amendment that my committee administrator is reminding me of takes us back to the Board of Nursing section. So I'll go back there after I'm sure Senator Wicklin were resolved on the AP, any questions or discussion. There's no other changes to the APRN portion of this bill.
Members, do you have any questions about the APRN section of the bill? I don't see any other questions.
Okay, thank you. So then one final amendment then to this bill is on page 4, line 24, after convicted, insert on or after August 1st, 2014. This is the 8th. A8 amendment.
Senator, Oh, okay.
So and it should be distributed.
Thank you.
And as this is being distributed, as we moved through a judiciary, we became aware that the language in the bill in this section would have allowed a look back, a significant look back, so that if somebody was 20, 30 years into practice and something emerged, that it would be a condition for dismissal. So we wanted to prohibit that. So this language sets a restriction on a look back for past criminal offenses.
Members, do you have any questions about the amendment? All those in favor of the A8 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes.
Okay, thank you. So that is completes all of the discussion I have on this bill, and I would happily make the motion to move.
Move. Senate File 1484, as amended, be passed and referred to finance. Is that your motion?
That's my motion.
Any other discussion? Senator Lori.
On that motion, then, too, I mean, I think just procedurally, just to talk with folks, it'll be referred to the Finance Division. And as this is just state government special revenue funds engaged in this bill, there's no general fund impact in this bill. And over in the finance divisions, we have very tight timelines that folks who are watching Health and Human Services are aware of. We have to get our article completed by Monday, the 31st of March. This bill will likely be heard with other special revenue fee-supported activities after we get our article completed. That's the plan we're working on, right? And
Senator,
I know
Sharon,
that's been a matter of some concern. So we will have another look at these things, and it'll be that same week so that we can make deadlines, but it'll be after we complete the budget article to send over to the full finance committee.
All right.
What is the next item on the agenda?
Let's vote on
this. Have we vote?
All those in favor of passing Senate File 1484 as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. And now, what is next? Senate File 511 is next on the agenda.
Senate File 511 is the APRN bill. The APRN bill, Ms. Kavanaugh, with the amendments that we've just made, do I need to re-amend those onto the 511 bill?
Yes.
Okay, so I would like to bring up Senate File 511 and offer the A7 amendment to the 511.
Senator Sharon offers the A7 amendment, and we're discussing Senate File 511. Do we have that? Is that the same?
Just as a reminder, this is the same amendment we just discussed for TRNA.
Members, have any questions? All those in favor of the A7 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
Then my motion for this is the same bill, so 511 be passed.
Oh,
and
Senator Sharon, there's one more, the oral amendment
well. Make sure that goes
to the...
Yes, the oral amendment to eliminate the term doctor. Let's see if I've got that amendment in front of me here.
You just incorporate all the same amendments.
On page 88.
Page 88, the lines are...
I don't have...
On page 88, lines 88.25, 88.26... which eliminates C, an advanced practice registered nurse with an earned doctorate may use the term doctor or abbreviated doctor. I'd like to have that language eliminated.
Members understand the amendment before us. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Is that
concluded? And then the motion is that the bill pass and be referred to finance.
On Senator Sharon's motion, All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you. What's next on the agenda? We haven't been called yet, so I'm thinking if we can do a little more, I'd be...
The next item on the agenda is Senate File 2754, Senator Laurie's governor's proposal.
So let's go.
Get started.
Let's go.
I should have did the Civil War. I heard there's a...
Absolutely.
Continuous agreement. Look at this. After the view.
Speed my turnaround is fair play amendment.
So I didn't look through this bit.
Just read that my turnaround is fair play amendment. Oh, your side.
Check on me here.
It is.
I try not to.
Welcome, Senator Laurie. For those who are here, as you know, we're being called to session this morning. We anticipated it would be at 9:30, so we're just going to continue until we're under call. And then we'll recess and come back and finish our work after session. Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair, I've got Senate File 2754. This is the Health and Human Services sections from the Governor's Supplemental Budget Request split out for our consideration here today. I do have an author's amendment, an A1 amendment, that I'd like to offer first to bring the bill into shape. So I move that amendment.
Senator Laurie offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
With that, given that it is the administration's proposal, I will let them present. I think we'll start with Lauren Coleman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner at DHS for Continuing Care. I'm going to speak to Article 4, the Community First Services and Supports portion of the bill. For background, legislation passed in 2013 establishing the new Community First Services and Supports Program, a reform of our current existing personal care assistance program. CFSS, as we refer to it, will be more accessible, flexible, and will help people transition out of institutional care, prevent or delay future admissions, and support people to live in their communities.
Would you hold just one moment? I want to orient the committee that among your materials, you'll see something that looks like this. And this is a handout on the Department of Human Services supplemental budget recommendations. And what's being described right now is on, it's on the page number 7 at the bottom of the page, but it really is the first. We have pulled out the segments here that fit. You don't have a copy.
I don't have a copy. I'd be interested in it.
You'd like to have one. It's in your packet, so we'll have to try to get an extra copy to you. It is something that we reviewed in finance, but I thought the descriptions would be helpful to the members of this committee, especially if they haven't been in finance. So excuse me for interrupting you, but I thought that might be helpful to orient the group to what you're talking about, which is the Community First Services and Supports Policy.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. To continue on the Community First, the 2013 legislation required the department to work with stakeholders and the Community First Service and Supports Implementation Council on several items, program integrity, among other things. These proposed changes include some of those recommendations that were contained in the November 2013 legislative report regarding the CFSS program integrity. To highlight a few of the elements, it provides the authority to establish a payment rate methodology for consultation and financial management services. In the new CFSS program, consultation services and financial management services are required by CMS to be available. So all CFSS recipients, whether they're using an agency model or directing their own services will have access to consultation services. There's a policy change contained in the bill that allows parents of minors and spouses to be paid as direct support workers. There are certain parameters to the number of hours a family caregiver can be paid under the proposal, and these limitations are consistent with the policy and practice that are currently under the Minnesota's other self-directed programs, communities, consumer-directed community support, and the consumer support grant. There are some language changes to the that reflect service design and policy decisions for service standards, service delivery, and program integrity. It establishes billing requirements under the new Community First program. These provisions include individual enrollment and each caregiver being specified on the billing claim line. Minimal timesheet requirements such as time in and time out, and time limits on the amount of hours allowed. It limits the number of hours that a caregiver can bill for and be paid. The proposal establishes a limit of not working more than 24 hours a day and a limit of 275 hours per month. This will make the hourly limit consistent with the current PCA program.
Not more than 24 hours a day?
That's correct.
Madam Chair, you may recall in the OLA audit there was an issue with that. So.
Nice to articulate the 24 hours is a day.
Seems like a reasonable instruction. We know of no opposition.
Senator, that's a new policy, 24-hour days. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, we may wish there were more than 24 sometimes. But Mr. Coleman, wasn't that legislative auditor saying, wasn't that there had been a mistake where somebody had been billing multiple folks under the same one? It wasn't really somebody actually intending to pay one person more than 24 hours a day. Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Coleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think there were a variety of circumstances that were clarified under the audit, and so we're being very explicit around the billing requirements. I think, my memory is a little foggy. It's a number of years ago, but it was a change that was enacted as part of that PCA reform package, and it's helped to help to clarify what we're able to pay for.
Madam Chair, I just
think
it begins to look a little bit silly saying you can't pay somebody more than 24 hours a day. When there were mistakes that were made in terms of how things were reported, maybe you need the language. I'm not sure you do.
Please continue, Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. Additionally, we're clarifying some financial liability. The proposal clarifies who's financially liable for any overpayments or violations of the applicable rules, regulations, and statutes regarding Community First. For individuals who choose the budget or the self-directed model, the fiscal management services contractor, not the service recipient, is responsible for overpayments or violations of applicable statutes or rules. We've added several provisions regarding background study requirements for the CFSS program. While the current program contains some background study provisions, there are several key factors that need to be addressed. The added provisions include information on who needs to request a background study and the requirement that a clearance letter must be received prior to starting any service. Background study fees for Community First are consistent with the current PCA and other DHS programs. Those are the highlights of the Community First policy changes that we are advancing.
Let's take that as its own subject. Does anybody have any questions about this particular portion of the supplemental budget? There's someone else at the table. Are you wanting to speak to this issue? No. Okay. The next section probably is going to take us a little bit, right? We are under call, and so I'm is that Ms. Henry? I haven't got my glasses on.
Yes, it is.
Yes, okay. Ms. Henry, if you could, I think we'll take your input, and then I think we're going to have to recess.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Thank you for the opportunity. We have just seen the language yesterday, and so there were some very significant concerns. But quickly this morning, we've been in deep conversation, and our concerns specifically were around Section 10, 17, and 20. 20's been deleted, and we're working on language changes. So I won't take any more time, and we'll keep on working. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, and I will reiterate that, yes, we are working together. We're aware of issues as they come forward, and we will continue to work to resolve them as we move through the process.
Would you mind, Senator Lori, are they policy issues that you could just highlight for us that you're, you know, the subject areas of which you're working around that may be policy related?
Well, the one that we're working around, I don't remember which section, I think it's section 17 that we were talking about, has to do with the way it's drafted, it sounds like a restriction for people moving between, for direct care workers moving between agencies. It's not intended that way. It's probably something that does need to be in statute, but it may not be worded perfectly right now. So we're hoping to be able to move that out of this committee and continue that work. If it isn't able to be resolved, we would drop it later.
And that's probably it for the policy issues that you had, Ms. Henry? Yes. Okay, great. All right. So we'll leave this subject and move to the next, but we'll do that when we come back after session, so our committee is in recess at this time.